We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we continue our big two-hour financial doubleheader. This is a topic that we feature every month on the show. It's always on Friday, and generally with the one of the three guys who's here, Dave Sino. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And every once in a while, if he's not available, then Kevin Waspy, who is here. He's a lecturer in finance, is here. And also, as our third guest, John Masetich, who's an adjunct lecturer of finance. His business is out in San Diego. That's Kensington Financial. He's also been here on the program. Occasionally, he's here and does spend some time teaching over there in the College of Business. And Dave roped both of them, brought them along. So all three are here in the studio, and you can take advantage of their broad financial experience. If you have a particular question about your own financial planning, the one or two or all three of them will see if they can help you out. Now, they also have been sitting here and listening to us talk about the need to support the station. This is the last weekday of our spring pledge drive. And when we started out, we said we had this goal. We hoped that we could hear from 1,000 people during this week. I think that the last number we had was, we said, so far on the week, we were at 814. And I think we might just be a little bit ahead of that at this point. Maybe it's now 815. Anyway, we're trying to get as close as we can to that 1,000 number. And they were sitting here listening and said, well, okay, we'll see what we can do to encourage some people to call with their pledge. And they said if we could get as many as 20 people to call this hour, during this hour of focus, then what they will do is match every one of those with an additional $15. So that means no matter how much you pledge, your pledge is actually worth $15 more. And I'd say that that's an outstanding offer from them, a great way to encourage people to support the station. So this is the time to do it. If you've been thinking about it and said, yeah, I'm going to get around to making that pledge, now is the time, because each of these guys is going to kick in some money to help us out and get us where we want to go. So the bottom line is here, it's time for you to make your contribution. If you listen to the show and other programs on WILL, now's the time. And it's real easy. You can call 217-244-9455 and make the contribution that way. If it would be a little easier for you, and a lot of people now are doing it this way, you can go online. Go to our pledge site, which is willpledge.org. Any way you do it, we hope that you will. We're now raising the money that will fund next year's programs. One thing we certainly know is the government support, it's just not there anymore. We have to rely on listeners to be the main source of energy to keep the station going. And this is the time to do it. So once again, 244-9455. That's the number. 217 is the area code, or go to willpledge.org. Well, we will continue to take questions here. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 with our three guys, Dave, John, and Kevin. I want to come back here to somebody who heard something that Dave had said at the beginning. And I'm beginning to think, I'm wondering if you might actually have misspoken. Did you really mean that for the emergency cash, people needed to have 3 to 5 years?
I'm saying they need to have money? An emergency fund, but right. If they are going into retirement,
Okay.
So they don't have to hemorrhage those stock positions.
Okay, that's good. Now, because I think probably for most people,
absolutely,
it's the
3 to 6
like,
months of expenses.
3 to 6 months, and I think that the person who was listening heard that, and depending on where they are, I mean, maybe that would apply to them, but essentially they were saying there was no way in the world that they were going to have that much cash stuck aside.
So, I'll also add to that, David, maybe you would agree that maybe some short-term, high-quality short-term bonds could
absolutely
be there 3 to 5 years.
As long as it's in the – I feel more comfortable in the 1 to 3 year maturity.
Yeah.
But basically liquid assets that are not – if you had to – liquidate them, you're not going to suffer a tremendous diminution of value.
Well, I guess you hear the bottom line question issue problem, I think, for a lot of people is their ability to save and how much they can save. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would say, you know, we're living from paycheck to paycheck, or maybe we can manage to save a little bit, but our ability to save is really limited. And for that person, I don't know what you do. You look for places to economize, I suppose, and do what you can.
Absolutely. It's called spending less than you make. And this is antithetical to a whole generation of people, including my kids, who are wonderful kids, and probably most of our kids, who sort of grew up in a different environment, sort of fast and now, et cetera, of a fast and now generation. And I'm not criticizing anyone. It's the nature of the culture. And I think, Kevin, as you're pointing out, something about Money Smart Week.
That's the whole issue behind the Fed's emphasis on getting people to be smart with their money. Budgeting, sticking to a budget, those types of principles are the reason this educational process is being done. So all of the programs that begin tomorrow and carry on for the next week throughout Champaign County are geared to try to help people with their money. Making more money is not an answer. Managing the money that we're able to make is really the universal solvent for all. And it's kind of fun. I mean, we as educators try to get people to think about the value of, whether it's the value of a business, the value of a stock, the value of an activity in an economy. We in business, finance, education, we're all about determining value. How can we determine value if we're not good managers of our own flow of funds? Mm. So you know, part of this Money Smart Week celebration, one of the things the finance department in conjunction with the Champaign Rotary did was to try to bring this message into the local high schools. So we ran, as we have done now for 3 years running, we ran a video essay contest. So here's the kids who watch YouTube videos and the opportunity for them to make a video, the purpose of which is to educate their peers to be more smart with money. And National City Bank was kind enough to pony up a $1,500 prize for the winning contestant, which I understand was just announced at the kickoff meeting at the Champaign Library. So if I could, I'd like to congratulate the Power of Plastic, Jamie Anastasia, Alexis Burns, and Chelsea Gonzalez from Champaign Central High School. And they were sponsored by their teacher, Miss Diane Ecker, who also receives a teacher's prize in helping them do that. There was a second prize awarded to an entry from Centennial High School, Frauds Are Us, talking about identity fraud. Lexi Zahn, Gina Jung, Terry Pham, and Colin Forney. So, I mean, here are high school students getting excited about doing a little short 3-minute video to educate themselves and their peers about sound money handling processes. I think this is the kind of stuff that our whole economy can benefit from.
Yeah. And if people would like to know about some of the events happening in Champaign County during Money Smart Week, probably the easiest thing, and assuming that they have internet access, there's a website, moneysmartweek.org/Illinois. And if you go there, you can see that there are a number of seminars, informational programs. They're free. They're happening throughout the week, and they're aimed at helping people with some really basic questions, financial counseling, things like legal documents you should have, advance directives, estate planning, things that are aimed at trying to help you spend less money and deal with issues like health care and planning for retirement and debt management and building healthy credit and
just about
anything that you could think
about. That's right.
And some of these things are happening multiple the same program. It's happening different days, different times, so that people can hopefully fit it into their life and to their schedule. And there's a lot of good basic financial information here, and it's all free, and it's a thing that, you know, people should definitely check out.
There's just wonderful programs. I'm just looking myself on Tuesday, 4:30 to 6 o'clock p.m. at the Champaign Public Library, Health Insurance Boot Camp, Getting Prepared for Medicare. The program will explain the basics of Medicare in a manner that will make sense, that you will actually understand. If they can accomplish that, that's absolutely extraordinary. So I think it's a great week, a great program. I know the University of Illinois is very, very happy to be affiliated with it, especially the finance department, in conjunction with the Rotary and Champaign, as well as the Chicago Fed. Just lots and lots of opportunity.
Okay.
In any event, mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to something, the drivers of the economy, because, correct me if I'm wrong, fellas, but as I always recall that when we come out of these recessions in the past, that usually it's the state of California that sort of leads us out of these things through their high-tech economy. And, John, I want to turn to you and ask you two questions. Is that likely, given the status and the state of Arnold and the state of California, as well as California real estate, which still may, it seems to me, it's in a funk. I'm not mm-hmm. certain. So how do those things cut?
Well, I'm going to go back to an old cliche. This time it's different. And I'm not sounding optimistic either this time. In my opinion, I don't think California is going to snap back and lead us out of the recovery. We represent about 15 to 20% of the economy. And there is some evidence now that California real estate prices have bottomed and that they're up a little bit, a few percent. The evidence is everywhere in the Silicon Valley and San Diego, where I live, that even in Los Angeles. That's all true. However, I think why this time it's different, that we're not going to have this big snapback in California, is that our fiscal situation, believe it or not, is even worse than the Illinois fiscal situation. It's that bad. Mm. And we don't have the luxury of having a low flat tax of 3% as Illinois has. So Illinois, it seems to me, you know, they've got some slack. They can raise that tax rate a little bit. We're already with a top rate of about, I think it's 11 point something percent that just went into effect. I think it's actually 12 if you calculate it the right way. So if you're already at a top rate of 12%, we can't raise that very much more without driving out businesses out of California who, after all, create all the jobs, you know, private enterprise. So spending has to be cut, and there it's a sad situation. It's just total gridlock in the capital, Sacramento, as it is, I guess, in Springfield. It's probably even worse in Sacramento. And there was an estimate that came out the other day about our unfunded pension liability for public employees. Everybody was saying, well, the number is about $50 billion. We think we can handle that. But then some sharp person calculated that the real number was 10 times that. It was $500 billion or $500 billion. And, you know, that's really dire. So we are going to come back. The question is, how long will it take? And I think it's going to take a lot longer than normal.
It's really bad when you got two states like yours and ours when we go back and forth deciding who is worst.
Right.
We're jockeying for being dead last. That's not the position that you want to be in.
Right. I mean, in Illinois, maybe there's this, you know, history of corruption. You know, certain governors have gone to jail and maybe another one on the way, whatever. But in my state, it's quite the opposite. I think we have a very transparent political situation. I think there's actually very little corruption. The problem is that we're simply incompetent at the state level. Again, my opinion.
We have a caller here. We'd welcome others. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Naperville, line four. Hello.
Hey, guys. Good morning. I'm originally from California, and my family, still most of my family lives out there, and they're all scattered about. And a lot of friends from high school and college have disappeared and gone to other states because of the lack of jobs and manufacturing out there. And every time I turn around, it's like this state where, because of this, that state taxes are so high, companies don't want to pay the head tax and so forth. They leave to go to a, lesser taxed state. My concern is that we're losing, not just in the two states, throughout the whole country, we're losing manufacturing. And I'm a contractor by trade now. I used to work for the Forest Service out there. I got out of the Forest Service because they don't pay squat when it comes to fighting fires. And now that the trades are getting to be the same way, it's low bid, low bid, low bid. Now, I know in California, when I used to do this, you know, it was if you went out and said $15 an hour, somebody comes back and says $12 an hour and so forth. The cost of living is so extremely high out there. It's insane, but we're getting the same way. Do you guys see this level of living, your paycheck and whatnot, getting smaller and the cost of living getting more expensive? Do you guys see that? Kind of, it almost reminds me of Europe. I've been there, and we're getting to be the same way.
Okay. Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Who wants to jump in? I think the caller brings up some very, very important points. We hear economic reports that talk about the level of inflation, and for most people's daily lives, those are meaningless numbers. What it costs you to live is so, so, so highly variable. It's not only which state, but which part of which state. It's, you know, lifestyle. It's everything that goes into it. And now in terms of a competitive environment to, how should we say, sell a product, offer an hour of labor, so on and so forth, I think what we're seeing is the convergence of forces that have been building up for 25 or 30 years. And I see it this way. The important things that we basically have to have, world-produced and world-used commodities, are in demand, and the demand for them will continue to grow. That means those prices are going to go higher. So if you like to eat, the price of food is going to go up. If you like milk, the price of milk is going to go up. The other part about it, the energy costs. So if you have to drive to work, if you ride the bus to work, it doesn't matter. It still requires energy. I mean, unless you're walking. Energy is in demand. I think energy demand will continue to go higher. I'm looking, you know, the next 20 years. And I think energy prices will continue to go higher. But now we've got that weird kind of thing in this 25-year trend. We've got such a competition for labor in an environment where we can transport things very efficiently, knowledge included, from one corner of the globe to another. So the competition for an hour of labor doesn't stop at a boundary. It doesn't stop at, well, it's only an hour's drive for me to get to work. The competition for an hour of labor is increasingly fierce. So an ability to make a wage, whether it's measured as a per hour or a salary per annum, is getting fiercer at the same time that the costs of basic necessities are going to begin to grow higher.
And let me just jump in there also, Kevin, with respect to Bureau of Labor Statistics, which are showing inflation, which are often quoted by Ben Bernanke as very, very tame, somewhere in the area of maybe even 1% or even negative over the last 3 months. Well, the reason those statistics are skewed when we go to the, for example, to the grocery store and things are, we all know they're more expensive. We're at the gas pump today, it's $2.89. How is it possible that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is suggesting a 1% or 0.5% or even a negative rate of inflation? There are a couple of giant factors that go into their statistical analysis, one of which is rents and two of which is interest rates, which have trended continually down for some period of time. And as a result, when these national statistics are published, we hear that, well, inflation is only 1% or 0.5%, when we know in our heart of hearts and, more importantly, in our pocketbooks, that it's precisely the opposite. Mm-hmm. So I think those numbers are just dramatically understated for the normal individual. And secondly, I want to just reiterate what Kevin has said, is that business and labor knows no boundaries. that now technology can be exported and knowledge can be exported all around the world, and that is going to continue to compress wages. Certainly, it seems to me, in the United States, where wages enjoy competitive advantages in other countries because lots of these folks don't have to worry about health care. They don't worry about the negative externalities that affect their country, like pollution, etc. All of these things are heavily regulated in our country, further dampening the increase in the wage structure in the United States, which means we better pay an awful lot of attention to educating our public and educating people.
I have a couple of other emails here, and I have a caller I want to get right to. Let me do one of these emails because I think probably we can deal with the question in fairly short order, and I want to try to make sure we help this person out. Someone writes in that their daughter graduated from college 2005, since then has either been basically underemployed or unemployed. She has about $10,000 in student loan debt with the government, which is now in forbearance. But here's the essential question. She has four American Eagle Gold proof sets that were dated in the mid-90s that she inherited from her grandmother. So the question is, should she sell them to pay off the loan, and if so, where should she sell it? Otherwise, she has no debts other than the student loan. What do you think?
Well, first of all, when we talk about American Eagle proof sets, it depends on what kind of proof sets they are. But certainly they have substantial value. And remember that when you sell collectibles, that is going to be taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So let's say that she sold those for $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever they may be worth, or $2.50. That's going to be added, if you will, to ordinary income tax rates because her basis in those assets is probably zero. All right? That's one thing. Now, gold is at a high. There are any number of places that she could sell that. If she would like, she could certainly call me off the air. The caller could email me. I'd be happy to refer them to at least two reputable dealers where you would be properly treated and those proof sets would be properly evaluated. Because even proof sets can be sold for different prices based upon the condition of the coins in the proof set. They may be liquidated and they may be melted down for gold content. On the other hand, they may even have a higher numismatic value. So it's a little bit more difficult question. But if you are essentially in a private loan, a non-governmental loan, the bet is that you're paying a fairly high interest rate on that loan. And if there is an opportunity to pay that off and get rid of that debt, especially if it's a high-interest private loan, then I would be likely to say yes, probably at least some of it.
Well, what the listener says, that apparently she says this is a government loan. That at least that's what she says, the government has apparently said, okay, we'll give you a little bit of time here, but sooner or later they're going to have to come back to that. So, it sounds like first of all, your bottom line is you have to know what the value is first of all, and then maybe go from there. I don't know, John.
Following up on that, certainly assess what the value is right now, and assume it's a nice value. One thing that the daughter has in her favor, since she's unemployed, she's probably in a very low tax bracket, so paying as much as a 28% tax, which is the maximum tax on collectibles, that's probably a moot point.
And it probably is, because you get a personal exemption of $3,650, a standard deduction of $5,700. So the truth of the matter that she'd have to be – those sets would have to be worth about $10,000 before she would even incur any kind of income tax. So she's probably in that window of opportunity. That's a good point.
Yeah, she might be just in a 0% bracket or a 10% bracket.
All right. Well, hope that helps. We have some other calls here. We will try to get to just as soon as we possibly can. Continue to talk with our guests, David Sinnoh, John Masetich, Kevin Waspy. It's our regular monthly show on money management, and we've been doing these shows for a long time, long time ago when we started to put the program together. There were certain things that we decided would be good to do every month because we could rely on the fact that we would always have lots of questions. And this is one of those shows. An opportunity for you to call in, ask a specific question about your situation, get some advice, and put that into your, we hope, a big basket of research that you do before you make decisions. This is one of the places that you can stop along the way. We hope that this program has been of value.
and the other shows that we do that are similar, where you get to say, look, I got a problem. And we have somebody here on the program who has some expertise. You call in and we'll see if we can get you an answer. One major kind of show that we do, in addition to all the other programs that we just hope will add to your understanding of the world. That's what this program has been about now for more than 30 years. We've been doing it. And we want to continue to do it. The resources, though, are going to have to come from you. That's what we're here doing this morning. Every once in a while, we got to sit in front of the microphones and say, now is the time for listeners to be supporters. And it's very easy to do. You can call, you can go online, and you can help us meet the short-term goal we've set, which is 1,000 calls this week, but also the bigger goal of keeping the station going. Dave Teal is the program director for our companion station, WYLL-TV, and he's been spending some time with me here this week to encourage people to support the station.
Yes, and, you know, we've been talking a lot about investments here and such, and, I mean, I know that it's not the same sort of investment, but, I mean, we are asking listeners to make an investment of sorts. You know, you can put your $40 into the pot here, and, you know, you're not going to get an interest rate, but you are going to get a return, and that return is programs like the one you're listening to right now, but a great deal more. I mean, because, you know, Illinois Public Media, which is, you know, what we're calling ourselves now, you know, comprises a couple of radio stations and, you know, now really several television stations, internet. There's we do outreach efforts in the community. There's just so much going on beyond, you know, this program, and not to denigrate this program, because this program is great. We love this program, but there's just so much going on, and that's what your investment goes into. That goes into a pot and gets mixed in with everybody else's investments, and it comes out in programming that I hope you will agree is worth more than the $40 or the $100 or the $365. You put into it.
Yeah. By pooling everybody's contribution, then we can get this big pot of money to keep things going. And what we're really trying to branch out in as many different ways as we can, because we know in the future people are going to expect more and more services and to be able to get at it in more and more different ways. And that's one of the reasons why we have really tried very hard to develop our presence on the internet.
Right. Right. And of course, you know, a lot of people do listen to us on the internet. I mean, either as a live stream or even, you know, we have the extensive archive of Focus and AFTMAG programs. And it's just, yeah.
Well, you know, we've been talking for a while here. I don't think we've given the phone number.
We have not. And that's my fault. I apologize. 217-244-9455. They yell at you when you don't do that. So, rather the people running the pledge drive will come in and
they don't yell, but they will strongly assert.
They might smack you around the ears a little bit. So 217-244-9455. You can also make a pledge online. If you're listening online, you can just pop on over to willpledge.org and do it that way. And more people are taking that option now.
Yeah. And great. I mentioned at the beginning of the hour that our three guests here, Kevin and Dave and John, were very generous in trying to encourage people to support the station. And they said, look, here's what we're going to do. We'd like to see if we can get at least 20 calls in this hour. So we're about halfway through here, 20 calls in this hour. And they said, we will match every pledge, $15. So for everybody who calls in, no matter how much, each one of these guys is going to put $5 down on the table. And that means that no matter how much you contribute, your contribution will actually be worth $15 more. So if you're thinking about it, been thinking about it, well, how about now?
This would be a great time.
This would be a great time. Sometime in the next half an hour, and we'll get an extra $15 from these guys here, in addition to the fact that they've given us 2 hours of their time. And at their billable rates, we're looking at thousands of dollars
right
already here over these 2 hours. So thank you very much, Dave. We want to get back to the callers here. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to get another email here, and then we'll get some more calls. And this may be too complicated for us to do. I don't know. But here we have someone who's raising this question that they're concerned for people who may have suddenly some catastrophic health bill to deal with. And they said for themselves, they have Medicare. They're in an HMO, but they're really concerned that many of family members are not so protected. So here the question is, you know, what do you do to prevent your for whatever savings you've got being eaten up if suddenly somebody gets sick and you find yourself with a huge bill, and you know, and we know what that can mean. You know, it could be $50,000, $80,000, $100,000, $200,000.
In 2 days.
You know, we know how that, that can go.
Absolutely. And obviously, it continues to be a diametric problem. It was attempted in some measure to be dealt with through Congress and Mr. Obama, and some people think this is a good idea and some people think it is not. We're not going to go there. I'd rather get to the economics of the issue. Understand, in the U.S. of A., we are an employer-based healthcare system, and that is, by and large, most people in the United States garner their health insurance coverage through their place of employment. That's number one. Number two, if you're not employed privately, then you may be under a government system of care, i.e. Medicare, which is scores of billions of people. Maybe it's VA care, whatever. Mm-hmm. But largely for most of us who are not 65, it's going to be an employer-based system. And the truth of the matter is that if we are unemployed, it's almost impossible to pay for the kinds of medical insurance that is necessary, because that cost for the average American family can easily be, a family of four, $1,000 a month, $12,000 a year. It's just an enormous problem, and there is no simple solution to it. We'll have to see how the recent legislation is going to play out. But keep in mind that while increased taxes are going to take place starting next year as a result of these changes, the actual medical changes, the actual benefits to certain people who are uninsured probably are not going to kick in for somewhere between 3 and 5 years, because a lot of the regulations have not even been written yet. Having said all of that, there are things called major medical policies, right? And that is one sort of stopgap solution. And that is where you buy a policy that will cover you for that gigantic bill, that $25,000, $50,000, $75,000 bill, subject to a fairly substantial deductible. That deductible might be $2,500 or $5,000, and still you have to pay a premium every month. But most people don't think about that, and that's something that folks need to look into. It's called a major medical. Now, it is often done in conjunction with something called a health savings account, but a lot of people can't even afford a health savings account, so they need to look at something called a major medical. The truth of the matter is that if you don't have insurance and you end up in the hospital, most hospitals who accept Medicare patients or any kinds of federal benefits can't turn you away. All right, you show up in the ER, they literally, as a matter of law, can't turn you away. A doctor in a private clinic, however, can, but a hospital can't. So this is one of the issues at hospitals and one of the reasons that things are so expensive. John, you wanted to jump in.
I just want to reiterate how important it is to have that private insurance policy. If your employer does not provide you one, then you really need to go on the private market and buy one. Now, I'm 63 years old. I've had mine ever since I became self-employed about 27 years ago. And I would start with one of the Blues, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, have pretty competitive rates. And personally, I'm aggressive about the copayment or the deductible. I'm minus $5,000. So I'm not protecting myself, you know, over minor things. It's the big one, like a heart attack or something, which can ruin your whole weekend. financially speaking and otherwise. So I'm willing to spend the first $5,000 of my money first to protect myself against that $100,000 or $200,000 bill. So I think the Blues are a good place to start. Or an HMO. In California, we have Kaiser Permanente. I think it's the oldest and the largest in the country. That's also a good place to start. I think there are HMOs in Illinois too, aren't there?
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of the largest in the country are in Illinois as well.
Okay.
There are ways to shop for health insurance plans, whether it's an HMO type of plan that might be co-pays along with routine services, routine checkups, those types of things, or to the other extreme, the major medical plans. But wherever the person lives, I think they should seek out the local advice. For instance, in Champaign County for people that don't have employer-sponsored plans. I know the the Champaign County Farm Bureau basically can act as a collective type of purchasing authority. So there are, through different local organizations perhaps, ways again to try to get a group price as opposed to an individual price.
Okay. And exactly, Kevin. Basically, you may even be a member of an association, and that association may be offering a medical program. So think about whether you are eligible as a member of some type of association.
Yeah, for example, an alumni association comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. Well, hope that at least gives you something to think about and start out with. We have some callers, and we'll try to get them in the time that's left, and we'll start in with Lexington, Illinois, and line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Enjoy listening to your program. I heard you talk about the housing foreclosures, maybe millions of those. It seems to me like government policy has been a big cause of that, where people's mortgage interest is deductible for their tax, their income tax, and there's no incentive for them to pay down. In fact, they remortgage their home, refinance, and take money out. It looks like there ought to change that IRS law or tax law so that there's an incentive to pay your house down after a few years, maybe for young people, and then after 15 years or so, do away with that. Well, what's your comment?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting issue. We only have to look to Canada, country to our north, and interestingly enough, there is no deduction on interest in Canada. And if you look, even in the last 2 years during this global financial crisis, Canada largely escaped unscathed in the housing industry. And the Canadian banks and the Canadian government quite proudly point to the fact that a great deal of that is probably due to the fact that interest is not a deductible item. So that gives us pause for concern, pause to contemplate, and your point is well taken.
That's an extraordinarily popular deduction. It's one that is... I think of all of the potential deductions there are, it seems to me that that's one of the ones that is available for the greatest number of people. So you would be making a lot of people unhappy here in the United States if you phased that out.
You know, it's quite interesting, though, that it's really a misunderstood deduction. For example, if you are a married couple filing a joint return, for example, your standard deduction is $11,400. You get that. Versus itemizing. Now, if you have interest on your home and some real estate taxes, it might not amount to more than $11,400.
Right.
And indeed, it's only the amount over the $11,400 that you are truly benefiting from. Now, if you live in that fancy state where Mr. Macedich lives in California, where, you know, a garage costs $2 million, well, those folks might feel differently about it. But I think you have to consider it in the totality of that standard deduction.
Yeah.
And you'll find a lot of people aren't getting the bang for the buck that they think they are.
You have to manage to put together a number of things and just your interest and your real estate tax. If that's pretty much what you got to deduct, usually the standard exemption, you're going to do much better.
Right. And David's hit on a great theme here with the caller coming to this question. When you look and see what type of what the tax code says now about the availability, the benefit availability to a person, talk the next step, think the next level about it, too. Last year, 2009, of all of the eligible taxpayers, of all income tax returns filed federally, 47% of those filed returns paid no federal income tax last year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we imagine when we hear about doing away with the interest deduction on mortgages is putting the everyday carpenter, bricklayer, cement worker out of work. You know, you're gonna kill the housing trades if you do that. And I think a closer examination of that knee-jerk reaction is probably warranted in light of, as David pointed out, many people don't even really get that advantage given the tax code exemption in the standard deduction right now, plus the fact that 47% of people last year that filed a tax return didn't even pay income tax. So that tells me they obviously didn't get an exemption benefit from. So are we dealing with a potential here that is something that we've allowed to go on without really giving serious thought to? I think it's worthy of examining.
Okay. On to another caller. Urbana, line two.
Good morning.
Yes.
I really appreciate the program in general and today in particular. I'd like to return to the point that was made a few moments ago about the inadequacy of the Consumer Price Index as a true measure of costs for families.
Yes.
And point out that that same inadequate measure, in at least in Illinois, is used to cap taxes for a number of public agencies, our schools, our libraries,
no question,
our park district, each of which also face a market basket of costs dramatically different from what is measured by that consumer price index. When the money runs out, those public agencies are forced to go back to the public for a tax increase. And every single time they go back, the question comes up, why can't you manage your money better? You have to live within your means just like everybody else. Obviously, I have a point of view about that. But it's another measure of some sort of circular argument that gets us into trouble and diminishes the services that many of our public agencies can offer.
Yes, and I think you're preaching to the choir here in some senses. You know, since March of last year, the Consumer Price Index, as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is up about 1%. I know as a former school board member myself, I know what the price of education, how it goes up each year. And that's far beyond just the salaries, the paper, the books, the supplies, the energy. It all goes up a whole lot more than 1.1%. And if you are in a district where you have tax caps, that puts you in a very difficult situation.
Exactly. So I'll just say thank you once more for a program where we can at least get that perspective out more broadly in the community. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go on again. Another Champaign caller here, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for the wonderful show. Back to the mortgage interest question, or I just have a quick comment about the mortgage interest. People need to realize that the mortgage interest or the payments you pay to service your loan are profits or are being sent to the bank or the credit union. And you can get just as much bang for your buck taking a lesser mortgage on your house and donating to charity. So I've chosen to spend my money on a smaller house and give more to my charity in my community. So it's all, whether you itemize or not, that's a good thing to consider. And that's my comment. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, that's very laudable. She makes a very good point that obviously when we look at itemized deductions, that the charitable contributions are certainly itemizable, but that's not really the reason that people make charitable contributions. There have been lots of studies that have been done. In fact, development officers have studied this a great deal, and what they find out is that people really donate money because of an altruistic feeling, a passion they have for an individual charity, and then the tax deduction is sort of a nice benefit on top of it.
I have one more email here, and I'm interested at least maybe seeing if we can talk a minute or two about it. And it comes from somebody who was listening earlier in the program, listening to the conversation about the recommendations that at least people have some of their money invested in the stock market. And the caller raises an interesting point here, and it has to do with why it is that maybe some people are suspicious of or afraid of stocks because the prices sometimes don't make a whole lot of sense. And here is the example. I like this very much. It's just, this is a case in point from today's New York Times. It's about Google and its stock price. And apparently, the company published the top published forecasts on Thursday, reporting the net income for their first quarter jumped more than 37% from the recession-mired quarter of a year ago. Sales grew 23% from the period a year earlier, but the stock was down nearly 5%
in after-hours trading because apparently the results were not as good as some stock analysts had been expecting. The shares closed at $5.95.30 in regular trading before the earnings release. And I guess the point is that, a 37% jump in net income resulted actually in a dip in the stock's value. And the person who was listening here said, essentially, what is that about? Where's the logic in that?
Well, I have a couple of comments, but I'm going to defer to Kevin because Kevin has talked about Google stock for several years. I think you can't get hung up in day-to-day on any individual stock. That's sort of just an overview because stocks react to all types of things that are just beyond our control on a day-to-day basis, and that's why I've always cautioned people to take a longer-term view unless you are an investment professional and you're trading for a living day-to-day, et cetera. And even that is fraught with difficulty. But, Kevin, with respect to Google, I know that you have a perspective on that particular stock.
But before we go straight to Google, I'd also remind listeners that David and John each are strong advocates of a diversified approach to investments. Mm-hmm. So we might talk about the stock market, but really then when we shift to talk about one particular stock, we're taking a quantum leap if we're going to look at some type of a diversified approach to stocks. But I'm comfortable talking about single stocks because I'm silly enough to buy single stocks myself. So in looking at Google, I understand what the listener is talking about, but let me just point out a measure, and then I'll use a few words as a classification or categorization. The stock is currently trading at 27 times the latest earnings per share the company has reported, which means to say that you're paying $27, in essence, to buy a dollar of earnings the company has already reported. Now, to give you a reference point, right now, the entire stock market in the United States, large stocks, that is, are trading at roughly 15 times that same past dollar of earnings. So if you want to use the P.E. ratio that I've just indicated as a popularity measure, we can see that Google is a very popular stock compared to the average stock or the market at large. And here's your rule of thumb. The higher the P.E., the greater volatility in stock price, particularly with a relationship to an earnings report. So it's a classic storm. It's a pricey stock, pricey meaning popular, pricey meaning a multiple on the earnings the company has reported higher than other market-type companies, and now a reaction to an earnings report. So if the earnings estimates, if the price is a reflection of the future earnings of the company, and my expectations have already been built into what I think the report is of earnings will be, hence that's where the price should be, and now I'm disappointed, the reaction is often a very volatile decline in the stock price. Might last a day, might last a week, might last a month, might last until the next quarterly report of earnings. Bottom line is this. These are great coffee conversations, beer conversations. These are great things to talk about over name your favorite beverage, okay? Coffee table talk. But in terms of actual investment application, I think really should only serve to illustrate some of the reason why we advocate a diversified approach with a sensible reassessment on a regular basis, rebalancing for the lack of a better term. And then the rest of it is just entertainment value. Quite frankly, I love the entertainment value I get from analyzing and buying individual stocks. Call me twisted, but that's a part of the reason why.
And one other point I just wanted to make, and Kevin, you mentioned this, that the overall stock market is trading at about a 15 PE, and that's a lot closer to history. Usually we're somewhere around 13, 14, 15 historically. So when people ask me, is the stock market cheap? No, it's not cheap. Is it particularly expensive? No, it's not particularly expensive. It's sort of in that sort of historical range. And John, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, well, Kevin, I just want to follow up with Kevin, though. Isn't it true that the P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 is actually about 21? Or is that being distorted by something?
Well, when you say historically, what history would you like to look at?
Oh, I don't know. Let's say the 15 PE norm, you know, going back eons, PEs have been about 15 to 1 on the broad market. I looked at the S&P 500 the other day in the Wall Street Journal, and I think it was about 21 or 22. That would imply some danger, maybe.
Yeah, and maybe if I should look at the numbers more closely, I should be talking about trailing earnings versus forward earnings.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're trading at 15 times forward earnings, what most people are anticipating the earnings in the coming 12 months to be, that I think is a more popular or more, I hate to say it this way, a more professional way to look at it, mm-hmm. unless all of our earnings forecasts are totally bogus. So on a forward multiple basis, I would say we're about a 15 number now.
Mm-hmm.
On trailing 12 months, we do have to remember that in the S&P 500, a tremendous component of the S&P 500, even with the decline in the stock values, but still about 18% of the S&P 500 is attributable to financial stocks, which obviously bank stocks, which just got the snot beat out of them in spades. So we've got, you know, earnings that are negative in that component that attribute to the trailing 12 months earnings that are very, very low.
We're
hopefully an abnormal.
We're going to pretty much have to wrap up because we're here at the end. A month from now, Dave will be back. Some other time, these other guys are going to be back here. Is there any last sort of thing that you'd like to
Well, first, mention? I wanted to thank Kevin and John for coming because it makes it so much easier on me, to be honest, and it's just wonderful to get two other professionals who are extraordinarily sharp on a lot of these matters. And I just wanted to remind everyone to take advantage of Money Smart Week. Go to the website and attend some of these extraordinary programs that are going to be offered over the next week.
Yeah, that is, and that website, and for everybody who's got internet access, or maybe you might even have to go to the library and do it there. In any case, it's Money Smart Week. That's all as one word, moneysmartweek.org. And you put a forward slash in there, and then you put Illinois, and then it'll show you what's happening around the state. And I think that actually there's also a way just to go to Champaign County events and find out
right.
about those two. And they're all, as we've mentioned, they're all kinds of things. The idea is what they're trying to do, the organizers here are trying to do, is create opportunities for people to learn and ask questions about how to manage their money, which is pretty much what we try to do with the show as well when Dave's here once a month. So I want to thank you guys all very much. David Sudon, John Masetich, Kevin Waspy. It's been great to have you here. We appreciate you giving us your time.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
And we also want to take one more opportunity here to remind people, if the last moment we're going to do here during Focus, encourage people to call in with their contributions. And Dave Teal is here one more time with me. Let's give him that number. Give him that website.
217-244-9455. We'll make sure we get that in. And, of course, willpledge.org. Very easy to make a contribution. We try to make it as easy as possible because we really do need to hear from you today. Don't put it off. This is the last morning for Focus during this pledge drive. And if you you value this program, we hope to hear from you right
yeah.
now.
And we will be here for the rest of this afternoon. We'll be here tomorrow morning. So there will be some other opportunities. And, of course,
any time
you can go on the website and do that. But if there might just be one or two folks out there who are fans of Focus,
right?
Well, this might be a great time to do it.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.
He's the program director for our TV station, WILL Television.